You can do loan assumptions where you're taking over someone else's loan, typically at a lower rate. The less variables you have now, the more certainty you have. If a deal works, hopefully we'll look back on it 2 years down the road and say, man, we got a really good deal on that deal.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I've got a really special guest on today, Mark Kenny with Think Multifamily. I've known Mark for 3 years now, I guess. I've been part of his mentor and coaching program. So he helped me get my start in the multifamily syndication game. He's got 25 years of experience in real estate, starting out with 2 to 4 units. Now he's purchased over 18,000 units, totaling $1.5 billion in assets across 14 states. It's a little bit of a longer episode because we just dig into a lot of stuff going on in the market, how he got started, how he started his coaching program, lessons learned over the last 25 years. So let's dig into this one and get Mark on the pod. All right, Mark, hey, thanks for being on the pod. Happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Justin. Good to see you again.
Yeah, man. No, let's jump right in. I have known you for a couple of years now, but I guess introduce yourself to the audience because you've been in this real estate game for quite a while. So give us your story.
For sure. I started buying a small multifamily, 2 to 4 units, 30 years ago, senior in college. I was buying with my identical twin brother. We both started corporate world as well. I was a CPA for a while, did IT consulting, had an IT firm. Continued to buy small properties, got married young, and my wife and I were buying small properties. And in 2013, a friend of mine was putting a deal together through a syndication, just a fancy word for raising money from people to buy larger properties. And I invested passively with him through retirement funds and did like another deal after that. So this makes some sense. And I had an IT business, as I mentioned, and it was doing well overall, but it was consuming pretty much every hour of my life, stressed up the wazoo. And I was sleeping just a few hours a night consistently and really didn't have much time for family. So my wife, Tamil, was like, hey, you need to do something different because this isn't working very well. So I said, oh, okay. So we start looking at doing larger multifamily. We started that and mostly like 100+ unit properties were our focus. And then since then, I'm on my 120th deal now as a general partner. Done. We're in 14 states, done about 18,000 units and about $1.5 billion value.
No big deal. Just,
well, you know, we didn't do it alone, right? I mean, as you know, too, it is. And I know people say, hey, it's a team sport, but it definitely went fast for sure. But it's not easy, right? And reality is you have struggles, you have pain points, you have frustration and things like that as well along the way, lessons learned. And that's one of the things to try to do is to share some of those lessons too, so people don't go through some of the pains that I went through.
So I want to go back to the beginning and then we'll work our way to present. But you mentioned you started back as a senior in high school with 2 to 4 units. So I always like to hear their origin of like how you even heard about real estate. Was that part of your like childhood? Did your parents talk about real estate or how did you get into it?
Right. So senior in college, I wish it was high school, but but either way, still pretty young overall. Yeah. And I'm one of 7 kids.
Okay.
My dad worked his butt off and my mom obviously worked her butt off. So put it this way, at one point we had 8 kids, right? So my mom had 8 kids in less than 9 years. So you can imagine she was a little busy when we were little.
Yeah.
And one of those things where we had food, we had a place to live, which is more than a lot of people in the world, but we had no extras. I mean, we were buying our bikes when we were 10 years old, buying shoes, clothes and things like that at a pretty young age. And I remember I talked to my mom, just like, man, this stinks not having money. And I never want my kids to go through this. And my dad would spend every hour. He wasn't working, which some cases he was gone up to 100 hours a week because he was a firefighter. And then he worked like 30 hours additional just on the side as a lumberyard. So my twin brother and I were like, we're youngest too, out of everyone, all the kids. And there was no one in our family doing it, no relatives doing it. We're probably a little more analytical just by nature. And we're like, man, people need a place to live. And I don't know why. Sometimes you wonder, is it something that you're just born with or is it something from your environment? In this case, I think I was very interested in real estate for whatever reason. My brother was too. And we just said, we're going to start looking at properties. And that's what we did, seniors in college, and took my dad along with us. And didn't matter how good the deal was. My dad thought every deal was a bad deal. And then we're just like, man, this is not working out. He had never bought a property other than his personal residence. So listening to the wrong person. But he was doing it to try to protect us.
Yeah.
But I don't really know why. I don't remember anything in my childhood that would lean me towards real estate. I remember always being enamored by real estate, loving. I don't know why. I look at modern stuff in general right now. I love it. I love cars. So I think it's something I was just born with somewhere.
Yeah. And then how did you do your first deal? Like, how did you have the capital to find that deal? And then how did you take it down?
So it was a 3-unit originally for like $36,000.
Okay.
$32,000, I think is what it was. Second place we bought was $36,000. So didn't require a lot of capital.
Right.
We had saved money just from working as kids. We started working pretty young, just mowing lawn, things like that. And then we got jobs, saved money through college. And it's one of those things where it didn't require a lot to put down. And I mean, it seemed like a lot at the time.
Yeah.
But that's how we just got started, is by saving money. And with the pricing being relatively small, we were able to come out of the down payment.
Got it. And then so you did that for a number of years, started your own IT consulting business or financial consulting business, right?
Yeah, IT business I started. So I was a CPA initially, then did manager consulting, worked for a large IT company as well. And then 2008 started my own IT company.
Got it. And then I guess you said 2013, you got introduced to the syndication world, and that was through a friend of yours that was raising some money. And one of the things I think is interesting, and maybe you can talk a little bit about it, is you invested in your first deal passively. So you kind of tried before you buy thing, but you also use retirement funds, which I had no idea was an option years ago. And I think people, as they start to get into the real estate world or investing, they think they need to have a lot of cash. And a lot of people don't have just hundreds of thousands of dollars right in cash. But there are things like an old 401k that you can roll over. So maybe talk about that first syndication deal that you were part of.
Yes. So I had money I had rolled over from a previous job, and I was investing. I had my own business, so I was also doing like a SEP IRA at the time, which contribute a fair bit for that.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things, my friend approached me on it. I'm like, well, this makes sense. And I will say, yes, you get to learn part of the business. But I also would caution people that when you hear statements from syndicators that will say, hey, come invest with me as a passive investor, and you're going to learn pretty much everything you need to know to do a deal, that couldn't be further from the truth.
Right.
The fact is, you're going to learn about 1 or 2% of it. It's good because you start seeing the monthly financials and things like that. And I had a financial background, so able to pick up things a bit quicker, people that like numbers and things like that. But I hated the stock market. I would actually get really discouraged on the stock market. I would get stressed about it. And people are like, oh, I lost money today. And I'm like, did you sell your stock? No. I'm like, you didn't lose anything. Just like you don't make anything if you don't sell a stock. So it became where I was checking my stocks every hour and then getting stressed about it. I'm like, this is ridiculous. There's no logic whatsoever. Nobody can convince me there's any logic other than corruption, frankly, in the stock market.
Yeah, it's definitely, I don't invest heavily in the market. I feel a diversified portfolio is the key word, right? Everybody talks about diversification. Sure. So having some exposure to it is not terrible. But yeah, I get nervous when people talk about, like, I have a friend who gives all of his money to his financial advisor, right? And it's like, do you know where that money's going and why it's going there? And he doesn't have any idea. So there's a lot of people I feel like that have that. They make a lot of money, so they just say, oh, give it to an advisor and let them figure it out. So going back to the syndication world, and you started passively investing, and then at what point did you flip over to wanting to go after bigger deals yourself? Because obviously, were you still buying the 2 to 4 unit properties at that point?
No, we had stopped that. And we looked at a lot of different things, by the way, in addition to multifamily, but landed on that, spent about a year doing that, figuring out what we want to do. And then 2015 is when we started buying on our own. So we spent a year looking at franchises and other asset classes. And then it took us several months to find our first deal. So it was one of those things where we knew we wanted to do it. We weren't sure when it was going to happen or how big the property was going to be. I came to the conclusion that I didn't need to replace my IT income necessarily, which I've been able to do. But it was one of those things, if I could even make half, then I would have at least a more balanced life, which I didn't have at the time.
Yeah, you're trading your time for money in the IT world, right? I'm assuming it's like the more time you spend, the more money you can make. Whereas if you can get some passive income coming in from your syndications, it frees up your time to not have to just keep churning away.
Right. I mean, any job I could get, I would take. In 20 years of consulting, I never had a day where I wasn't on a project.
Yeah.
People might think that's a good thing. It's not a good thing.
No, you've got family and you've got kids and you've got a wife that's like, hey, we need to spend some time together. And you're like, I'm making money. So,
and it had people that work all over the world, India, Switzerland, Australia, things like that. So time zones were a big problem. And I was horrible at delegating anything because I figured, well, if I'm capable of doing it, I should do it. At that time, I could have probably paid somebody $10, $12 an hour to do probably 10 hours of work for me a week. But I'm like, well, I can do it. I know how to do it. and I don't want to pay someone $10 an hour.
Right.
It's bad thought process.
Yeah, no, I mean, a lot of entrepreneurs, when they go out on their own, they're like, well, let me just control everything and do everything, even though your hourly rate is probably 10x what that $10 an hour was, right? So, but you're like, well, I can do it in 5 minutes. So why don't I just do it, as opposed to spending a few days trying to train somebody? But yeah, it's something I struggle with my recruiting business. I can outsource a lot of the stuff, which I have started to, but it takes a while to just let go of the reins a little bit. So I want to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk more about the start of your syndication journey and then where we are today. So we'll be right back.
Whether you're in a job you love or hate, building a financial foundation is important. This foundation can support you by providing passive income, stability in an uncertain economy, or the launching pad for you to start your own business. Great Venture Capital helps busy professionals invest in commercial real estate to build passive income streams, grow wealth, and take advantage of tax benefits. If you'd like to learn more, check us out at greatventurecapital.com or send an email to justin@greatventurecapital.com.
All right, we are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast with Mark Kenny. So before the break, we got up to the point where it's 2015, you started your own syndication journey. You spent a year or so chasing the shiny object a little bit, looking at franchises and land, which my wife and I got into, and we started our journey as well. Because once you start peeling back the onion, there's a lot of options out there. It's right. So how do you focus? And before we jump into what you've been doing recently, how did you pick syndication? Because you were looking at other things. Like, why didn't you go down land or the franchise route? How did you land on syndication?
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything wrong with some other investments. I invest in a number of other things as far as outside of multifamily. But with the land, it's the whole thing. There's just no cash flow. Mm-hmm. And I was really focused more on cash flow because I wanted to quit my IT business, essentially. And we looked at other, I like self-storage a lot too, but people need a place to live. Not everybody needs storage.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I think storage is a great investment. And the franchises, unfortunately, they all had a cost to them, which we could have done if you want to say, but I'm like, it's just another business. Most of those franchises force you, or you probably want to be the operator of the franchise. And I'm like, I'm just trading one for the other. So yeah. It was one of those things where, again, everyone needs a place to live. We knew that Dallas was becoming a pretty attractive market overall, even though pricing was really low then, but we could see a lot of things happening where we lived. So we said, hey, why not give it a shot and try to buy some larger properties? But I'm not knocking other investments. I think it's, like you mentioned, being diversified is great. But I do think there's some investments that people get into without really understanding the financial impact, positive or negative, to them.
Yeah. And what the goal is, right? Your goal is cash flow and freedom. Whereas somebody else may be like, hey, I want to buy a business that I can operate, right? And maybe a franchise is a good option for them at that point. So I guess I'm curious, back in 2015, what were deals looking like in Dallas, like from a price per door perspective?
Bottom of 30s a door. Yeah. Cap rates were 8+ for a lot of properties.
And what are deals looking like now in Dallas? Like,
pretty much all over 100 a door.
If you just would have bought every deal and held it.
Exactly. You would have only known for sure.
But yeah.
Dallas has come a long ways, I think, in a relatively short period of time. And I think that a lot of people came to this market, though, and drove price.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I live in Austin, and it's the same thing, right? I overheard a guy talking the other day at the gym, and he came into the market here in like 2017 or something like that. And deals down here were still in the 30s or 40s.
Right.
And how do you compute that when a deal now in a 70s built deal in Austin is going for 150, 200 a door?
200, yeah.
Like, holy cow.
Right.
So since 2015, you mentioned you've done, 18,000 units, over $1.5 billion in assets across 14 states. So obviously, I'm assuming you've got some deals in Texas. What other states are you in? And maybe what other states do you find attractive now? We're recording this late May 2023.
Yeah, so we're Texas and Southeast for the most part. So Florida, Georgia, Tennessee, Arkansas, places like that.
Yeah.
Of the 14 states we're in, there are certainly some states that I probably won't continue to invest in for a couple of reasons. One, how did the state, or in some cases, the county, if you want to say, react during the pandemic? We still have places today in Georgia where it's taking 9 to 12 months to evict. I mean, absolutely ridiculous. And then we have other parts of Georgia where it's just your standard couple months to get people out. So no logic whatsoever. Having the same, where a state is landlord friendly. There are some, you know, I would venture, like Arkansas is overall very landlord friendly. We don't own South Dakota, but I'm pretty confident that's a very landlord friendly state.
Yeah.
Wasn't so cold, I consider moving there actually. But Some of the other factors that have really driven it in a negative for some areas is insurance cost. So if you're on the coast, depending where you're at, we've seen insurance costs go from 3 to 5 times in a single year.
And that's not a controllable cost. You can't control that. Right. You can't opt out of that. You need to have that. And right. So it's just on you to pay it, right? So
right. You can't raise rents fast enough to cover right. that either. So some of the markets like that, if there aren't alternatives for insurance, then we're going to probably shy away from some of those markets personally for a while. I still like the markets that perform well during COVID as far as evictions and things like that. I like. And then just as a whole, we've bought in a number of, in some cases, tertiary markets, some cases, mediocre markets, and then deals as well. Some have been completely distressed, physically distressed, 0% occupied, 20, 30% occupied. I'm done doing those deals. Yeah. We've done really well on a lot of those deals. So we've adjusted as far as what states, how did they react during a pandemic was one. To how they're reacting today for insurance and property taxes. Pretty hard time convincing me right now. I own several things here in Texas and personally as well. Pretty hard to convince me that everything went up 5% last year. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Not for properties. And then, like I said, more the type of assets. And maybe it's because I'm getting older too, but I'd rather get some less headaches. Yeah, maybe not the home runs, but more of the doubles and things like that that seem to perform better over time. Demographic wise is huge. I think people are naive, probably ourselves included early on. Hey, we can go in there and do things like gates and cameras yeah. and re-tenant the property. Maybe, maybe not. So if your business plan only works if you re-tenant the property and do a huge CapEx, I don't do those projects anymore because we've been burned before on those.
Yeah,
I think your business plan has to work regardless of that happening. Maybe it won't work as well, but we had deals right before COVID hit and we were going to re-tenant them completely and do a big CapEx and we weren't able to do either for a yeah. while.
I'm curious, sounds like your typical deal was maybe like the 70s, 80s BC class asset in a good market, but maybe not like an Austin, right? And you're trying to bring it up to a better level of tenant. And sometimes you can do that, right? And sometimes you can't change a community typically, right? So if your property is not on the good side of the track, so to speak, it's hard to bring the rents up and re-tenant because you can't change the area, right? You can't move your property to the other side. And so now it sounds like you're moving a little bit upstream, going into the more B+. Are you doing any or looking at any A or new builds that you would just take over from a developer?
I definitely like the newer assets better. I mean, we have one right now. It's not new, but it's 91 construction. We bought newer than that before. I mean, definitely the 60s, 70s properties have more problems just because of certain way things they were built, right? And A, I would consider A for sure. A lot of them, the returns just seem a little bit harder to justify. With that said, some people might go, well, hey, less risk than A. I know a lot of people are doing it where they like buying the assets where someone buying from a developer and they have to lease up.
Yeah.
I think brand new properties, personally, from experience, they can suffer a little bit more. It sounds strange because they're new, but a lot of times they have to give some pretty large incentives for people to move in there.
Yeah.
And that goes on for a while. And then once you're filled up, then you can start increasing rents and things like that. But those first 18, 24 months, I think can be a little bit tough on getting high rents on those new properties.
Especially if we're going into some type of a recessionary period where people are losing jobs, especially those high income tech jobs, right? Where I'm in Austin, there's a ton of new apartment buildings or A-class. We moved to Austin in October of 2020. We got a free month plus $1,000 move-in concession for a 2017 build. Right. So I imagine they're doing similar things now to bring people into that A class. So I think the B class is the sweet spot because if you can't afford an A or maybe you lost your job or something, you would go to a B, but an A, you've got nowhere else to go, right? You can just
That's right.
raise the rents and some people can afford that. But if you're looking at a quantity play of like, who can afford my rent, a B is right in that sweet spot.
I totally agree. And like I said, characteristics of the property usually yeah. a little better. You don't have the cast iron plumbing typically. You're not going to have like a chiller, boiler, things like that. Those are all big ticket items that you can contend with. Now, don't get me wrong. Doesn't mean you can't make a lot of money and you can't have properties that are class C. Doesn't mean you can't have them perform really well and things like that. But yeah, I think people start there and lots of times conclude, I'd rather have a little bit less headaches, a little less unknowns and a little bit more predictability.
Yeah, when it's also like as you cut your teeth on some of the C-class assets, which maybe have a lesser amount of buyers for those, you say, okay, to your point, you're like, hey, I'm getting a little older. I want less headache. So let me go up a little bit higher in the market. Maybe I'll take a little lower return, but your variability is different for some of those B-class
assets. That's right.
So I'm curious if you wouldn't mind sharing one of the deals that you've done, and it doesn't have to be recently. It could be a first deal like that has gone maybe poorly. And you're like, I wish I would have known this or something like taught you some lessons as you refine your analysis of how to underwrite deals.
Yeah, I'm 120th deal. So I learned one or two or maybe 2000 lessons plus probably. A lot of lessons. I would say a couple of things. One, as far as the way evictions are handled is very important. It just is. That's one lesson, which I mentioned. And maybe we ever have another pandemic like that, but it's something to be aware of.
Yeah.
The insurance piece. But I would say, hands down, there's no question that once you close a deal, operational-wise, the asset management piece, and you have helped us. We've been scaling up, as you know, too. You've been helping us a lot with your recruiting business as far as getting resources into our company, things like that, which is very much appreciated.
Quite welcome.
And it's something, frankly, we should have started before. I mean, I can look there and say, well, I wish I would have done this a year ago. Can't go back in time. But the asset management piece is more critical now than ever.
Yep.
And some of the things, personally, in my opinion, any deals I'm doing going forward will have to have a full-time asset manager where they're not doing anything else. So if I'm on a deal, they can't go look for other deals. They can't be raising capital. They can't be doing X, Y, and Z. Their full-time job is asset management. So we start bringing that in-house, as you know.
Yep.
And wish I would have done it earlier. And that we've seen properties, not that someone that could just snap their fingers overnight, but we had properties, for example, just recently, one of the guys we brought in who's a complete rock star, but he brought it in 3 months from 78% to like 95% occupied.
Yeah.
And
I think I might know that deal.
Yeah. It doesn't mean there aren't struggles. Doesn't mean there aren't pain points, things like that. But that's one of the major, major things. The other one I would say is, as we go through, lesson learned is more capital on the raise. So not a disproportionate amount where like you're just diluting everybody. But I can tell you, we've had properties before. We're like, man, I wish I had more money there.
Yeah.
And I've had to put money in. Other general partners have put money into deals and things like that to sustain. It's not a good thing to have to do. So having more money when you close and then quickly making changes. As the owner of the property, you're paying for them. So you have to say who they are and who they're not. But the operation side is just imperative. And then the other big one, maybe not so much for like a limited partner, and you would think, but it is the loan structure. We'll obviously know certain loans where we don't have interest rate protection and things like that, which is a problem. Also getting loans from lenders that are operators, meaning they own their own multifamily properties. And if they wanted to take yours over, they would have an easy time doing it versus lender. If a lender that's like, hey, I don't want your property. I want to work with you. And I've done well over 120 loans now on different deals. We had some lenders that are really good to work with. We had some lenders that are horrible to work with. So a lot of lessons learned on the loan side as well.
Got it. Well, I think it's important to call out that I started my syndication journey late 2019 and realized very quickly that it takes a village to take down a 100 plus unit asset compared to a 2-unit asset, which you can do by yourself, right? And so when I started to underwrite deals, I was like, well, what happens if I find one? I don't have the liquidity or the net worth or the track record or anything to do that. And so I sought out a mentor and a group and obviously stumbled upon your Think Multifamily Family Syndication group. So I wanted to just call out one that it's been a massive help to me in my real estate journey. How did you guys start that? Why did you start it? Was that the goal when you started the syndication? Because I'm just very curious how that all happened.
No, no intentions whatsoever ever to do any type of education. Background wise, doesn't lend my background with CPA, IT guy doesn't lend itself to running events and things like that, right?
Yeah.
The touchy-feely type stuff. But it was really through some circumstances where we were part of a group and then we saw other groups out there that we were seeking. And it just seemed to us personally that there were a lot of weird rules, if you want to say, in certain groups, what you can and can't do, which I thought was bizarre. A lot of unwritten rules, what you could and couldn't do. So we were like, hey, let's ask other people what they're looking for in a group. And I'm not saying we're perfect by any means, but I can tell you, we do listen. We've changed a lot of things this year, and it takes time to get there. But it was really a function of whether people believe in God or not. But both my wife and I felt like, hey, we had a calling to do this. Both of us did not want to do it. In fact, we were working again, like my IT hours for a year plus, frankly, neglecting the kids for that year. unfortunately. But it was one of those things where my wife, Tamil, also wanted a culture. You mentioned it's called the Family Syndication Group, and it really was put together to have, one, to do deals, but also to try to have certain aspects where people are trying to help each other in other areas outside of real estate. And we have some things we've added this year, quite a bit, other things outside of real estate. And it's all extra. People might say, what is next month we're doing one on marriage? So what does it have to do with real estate? Well, if you're not married and you're getting divorced, those are all things that can impact you.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. So yeah, no intentions of doing it. We started out doing like webinars initially, and then meetups, half day events, full day event, and then just morphed into more and more. And then to be frank, we on a regular basis. So December of last year, both my wife and I said, we're going to spend a few days praying about it. And is this something we want to continue to do? Yes or no? And we both came back and said, yes, we do. People are like, why do you keep doing it if you don't have to?
Well, that's good for me.
No, I appreciate that. But it's really one of those things that we want to do. Doesn't mean we don't have some stress and headaches and things like that associated with it that we would have less. But I know what position I was in when I started, and I was looking back at it. My life is completely 180 degrees different than what it was. I mean, it just is. And if I can help some other people achieve that as well, then that's what I would like to do.
Yeah. And I mean, that's my whole vision for this podcast, because I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania. My parents' financial acumen was get a good job and invest in your 401k in the stock market, and hopefully you have enough in retirement to live a good life. And then I stumbled upon a book and then your group. And if one person finds this podcast and has a pivot and thinks about real estate or some other type of investment, as opposed to just the status quo of the stock market and everything, I think it'll be worth it. So now you have started to build out the team, and I appreciate the opportunity helping you guys do that with my recruiting business. It's been really cool to be able to bring a marriage between my recruiting business, which I've been doing for my entire career, and my real estate experience, which has been pretty cool. The asset management piece, I think, is to your point, is very important. And I think over the last 2 years or so, the market has papered over a lot of operational cracks and made bad deals turn out really good. I guess your experience, and was that the push point for you to say, hey, we need to bring this in-house and really batten down the hatches, if you will, from an asset management perspective?
Absolutely. To your point that the market kept going up and up and up, right? And then it's like, okay, now we're having some problems on some properties. Why are we having problems? And there's certain things that are out of your control, like the insurance, for example. Yeah. But there are other things that are in your control. And I've seen, just like in the IT business, I could see where, why is it working on a $300-400 million project? Why is it failing? Well, lots of times it's because of people, right? Yep. So it's no different than working on a multifamily asset management. We've seen a lot of examples, but to your point, it's really because of now you start having issues. And it's a little, don't get me wrong, very frustrating. But people are really all over this now, right? As far as like, oh, these issues and things like that. We talk about the stock market. I mean, how many people have lost money in the stock market, right? I mean, you're just talking about bigger numbers though on a syndication. So I will give you that. And people are like, oh, I just saw an article today where syndicators have nothing at risk. It's like, well, in some cases, we've had $1.5+ million earnest money that we will lose.
Yeah.
And what financial advisor has anything at risk? They collect the fees, and we put money into deals as general partners, in some cases, a very large amount of money in to help float deals. And I don't think you're going to get your financial advisor to put money into a deal.
They're going to match your losses. Right.
So I'm not trying to downplay the issue, because they're there, especially with the rate hikes, insurance, property taxes. A lot of people have done really, really well in real estate. And I think as a whole, people are like, well, should we keep investing in multifamily? Well, all people are doing right now is going back to what they should have done, right? Myself included in my head, right? But reality is, just use that information to make better decisions going forward. And if a deal works right now, there's a lot less uncertainty than there was before. I'm not saying there's zero, but there's a lot less uncertainty. Before, rates were going up nonstop while under contract, not just a little bit, 300 basis points, over 500 basis points in a pretty short period of time. So the uncertainty is a little bit better. You can do loan assumptions where you're taking over someone else's loan, typically at a lower rate. The less variables you have now, the more certainty you have. If a deal works, hopefully we'll look back on it 2 years down the road and say, man, we got a really good deal on that deal.
I wanted to touch on two things, but as you just said it, like, I feel like if a deal can pencil right now, whether it's a loan assumption or you're doing new debt, odds are you would think that it should be a pretty good result, just given that you're buying at such a high interest rate. If you think about buying a single family house right now, you love this house. Odds are, if you would have bought it a year ago, it would be a lot higher and you'd have to pay over asking price, right? And your rate would be lower, yes, But now if you have buy that same exact house, you buy it at a lower price point, you have a higher interest rate. But then in a couple of years, theoretically, if things go the way that it typically goes, the interest rate will go down, you refinance, and then you're made in the shade, right? In the beginning of this year, I was very hesitant and I went back into my hoard cash mentality of just put it in the bank, just keep it in the bank. And then luckily I've got a very supportive and very strong partner. And we're like, we need to think differently than what we used to think like, right? And so I think Warren Buffett makes this comment. It's like when everybody is scared, run into and actually invest. When everybody's investing, that's when it's time to be scared. So we're trying to push ourselves towards that path of like, if a deal works now, let's go. Let's do this.
And to your point about the bank, I mean, you were mentioning probably before, but now we've seen a number of banks that had total collapses.
Oh, yeah.
So people think their money's safe in the bank, safe in the stock market. So I'm not saying we don't have our share of issues because there are. Most of the issues are an interest rate issue.
Yeah. But it's also backed by a physical asset, right? That's right. The other thing that I love about it is like worst case scenario, this is not the worst, but like you sell the asset, right? You get rid of it and you return as much capital to your investors as possible, right? If the stock goes to zero, everything goes to zero, right?
That's right.
And so there's no safety net. I want to circle back to one thing about the asset management, just for the audience. And you talked about asset management being a very important piece. What does an asset manager do and how does that contribute? If you're a limited partner and you're like, hey, we just brought in a new asset manager, why should they care?
Right. So we have the property management company first that's running the day-to-day. So evictions, leasing, things like maintenance. And then while you would say, hey, these guys are professionals, they manage thousands of units, they should all be great. The reality is some of those people are phenomenal, but also the pay structure in some cases is pretty low for some of them. So some cases you're going to get what you pay for. And we need somebody as an asset manager that will oversee the property management company to make sure they're doing what they should do. Because even if things are going somewhat well, management companies can sometimes get complacent. And you want to make sure somebody else, a third party, the asset manager in this case, is making sure driving things to get done, CapEx to get done, renovations, things like that. And then typically the asset manager will also be responsible for communication with investors. They're responsible for reviewing the financial documents on a monthly basis, communicating out any issues that they have with that. And then other things like K-1s for taxes, things like that. But really, the reality is they're responsible for visiting the property, trying to make sure that the property is performing to the business plan, making suggestions and recommendations, because lots of times the business plan changes, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse.
Yeah.
And then trying to make those decisions for the owners as far as what are some things we can do to try to make things run more smoothly.
Yeah. And to your point, you're paying a property manager. That's baked into your expenses, right? But also in your analysis, you also have an asset management line in there, right? So you have, it's not an additional cost theoretically to the property to bring in an asset manager, have an asset manager. Somebody's going to be doing that job, whether it's the person that found the deal or you have somebody else that's going to be operating it, right? The pay is there baked into the process. So yeah, I have a few deals that you helped and brought in some asset management muscle to help out with. So in my mind, it's a great thing because it gives a professional feel to the whole process and also just gives the property management, especially with these renovation projects that we have that are typically important for the first 6 to 12 months of a hold of a deal. You need to have somebody that's going to be on you and making sure things are moving in like clockwork, because that's where the money's made, right? In that first couple of months to get the deal off and running.
It's where the money is made and people think of, oh, we just need to get it done to meet a business plan. But it's also lots of cases where the lender is providing the capital for the capital improvements and they have a certain timeline they want certain things done in. So you shouldn't just sit there and go, oh, we're just going to do the CapEx when we can. Lender can come back to you. Usually there's completion covenants, if you want to say, in loan agreements when you get to get things done. It's pretty important. Now, something changed over time. Like, hey, we're renovating the unit, spending $10,000. We're getting $30 rent bumps. I'd say, don't do it.
Right.
And pause. Probably could go back, right? Probably go back to the lender and have a conversation with them, renegotiate, things like that. But it's pretty tough if you can't get the stuff actually completed. That's the other thing people use. They always look for the cheapest contractor, call it kind of the chuck in the truck, where it's kind of a local contractor and things like that. Well, my experience has been, I actually would pay a little bit more to get a professional general contractor and get this stuff done quickly. Because I believe in the long run, you're actually paying much less
You can turn 10 units a month versus two or whatever the number is, right? Theoretically, you can get more online faster. If you are getting the necessary rent bumps, what, 100, 150 bucks, whatever it is, you're going to benefit in the long run than having Chuck in the truck. I like that analogy.
And then split it too, right? We've been guilty of this, splitting a unit. 80% is being done by GC, 20% by the maintenance people. Sounds like a good way to cut costs, but usually what happens is they just blame each other for things. It takes three times longer to get stuff done, bunch of rework. And in some cases, you end up with items that nobody's responsible for, apparently.
Yeah.
I'm much more of the opinion now, turnkey. Turnkey, you better have the unit ready so it can be rented. It needs to include blinds, it needs to include everything. So it's lessons learned.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole process, right? Nobody's ever gone through the last cycle, really, that we had, really, the ramp down, the ramp up of interest rates, and now we're paying the price for it, I guess, at this moment. So I'm curious what you think about the rest of 23 into 24. I hear this, like, survive the 25 and all that stuff, and it depends on the news outlet that you look at, if we're going to go into recession, if we are in recession, whatever. Right. I guess from a multifamily investing lens or focus, like, what's your crystal ball look like? Are you still a buyer in this market? Talk through that a little bit.
Yeah. So inventory has been down significantly for 2023. A couple months ago, it was down 74% for the year. So to me, this whole thing, I mean, you had me on a podcast 3 days in a row. I'll say three different things and I'll come back and say, look, I was right.
Right.
This is ridiculous. It's day to day. Nobody knows what's going to happen. If they say they do, they're just plain lucky. And frankly, if that's smart, then they're probably off in a beach living dream or whatever. But I've seen a big uptick in inventory, new deals coming out here in the last like 2-3 weeks, like more so than probably I've seen almost all year. Doesn't mean they're good deals, but definitely this next hike or not for the Fed will, I think, be very telling. And it's going to set the entire remainder of the year, in my opinion, people's sentiment. Now, I do think, to your point earlier, if you can find a deal right now that works in a high interest rate environment with low leverage, and you can have like maybe a supplemental loan option, which is, think of it more like a HELOC on your house, you can get another loan 2 years down the road. I'm all for those deals. People assume or think that Fannie loans and Freddie loans are all fixed and bridge loan is all variable. There are fixed bridge loans and there are variable bridge loans. There are fixed Fannie and Freddie and there are variable Fannie and Freddie.
Yeah.
But right now, I think getting a fixed rate, my personal opinion, is probably a real good choice, even though you could argue, hey, I think interest rates are going down. Well, maybe. Did you think we're going to have 10 rate hikes in a row?
Right.
I mean, every other day right now, there's no joke. You'll see what the Fed's going to do. I mean, literally, oh, they're going up. They're not going to go down. They're going to pause. So I have people, friends are like, oh, they're pausing for sure. Well, would you put all the money you have on that?
Right.
But it's going to be telling you, I think you always should be looking, if you're new to multifamily too, this is the best time in a long time where you have the attention of brokers, because brokers don't have a lot to do. In fact, right before this podcast, I just spoke with somebody. He was in Atlanta and said, I met with five brokers. And like, I think he was only there a day, by the way.
Yeah.
Maybe two. And that happened to be able to meet five different brokers in a day, day and a half, whatever it was, would not have happened 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah. No, I liken this a little bit to when I got started during COVID. Joined your program in February, I think, of 2020. And I was like, yeah, this is going to be a great thing. And then COVID hit and the world stopped. And I spent that year underwriting as many deals as I possibly could. And I got really good at it. And also, I spent time talking to brokers. And I think to your point, like, brokers lead the deal flow, right? They're going to be the ones that give this is not finding something on the MLS, like if you're a single family buyer or whatever. So you got to build those relationships. So yeah, I think right now, if you're new to it, probably a good time, especially if you can find a deal, like we said, it could be a really good home run, potentially, if you have the right asset management team and all that fun stuff. Sure. So I kind of want to wind us down here, because we've been talking, I could talk for probably another hour or so, but I know your time is very valuable. Two things I wanted to touch on. One, I guess if you think about the passive investor, right? Somebody that's listening to this podcast and they're like, just started thinking about multifamily or even just investing outside of the normal stock market or 401k. What do you think is a good thing that they can do as a first step to get into the multifamily investing space? Like, how do you think they should get started?
If they're going to be passive, they need to find someone that's going to be a lead sponsor. I think events are great to meet people. It's always nice to meet people face to face. You can do it online, of course. And then when you're looking at a syndicator or a lead, like, what have they done before? Are they full-time at it? Most everyone starts out, they have a W-2 job. That's fine. Right. I started out doing that too at my own business. But all things being equal, I'd rather have somebody that's doing it full-time, has done a number of deals, has made mistakes, willing to own up to the mistakes and what are they doing differently.
Right.
Now, if everyone's like, I have never had any problem, I just keep doing what I'm doing, they probably haven't been doing it long enough, because everyone's going to have some sort of issues over time. And then just other things, how are things handled for how well capitalized is a sponsor? Will they put money into a deal if they need to before going back to the LPs? And they're not required to do that, but have they done that before?
Yeah.
So you do enough deals, there are going to be some requirements typically for capital. And is a default just to run to every investor asking for money? It's fine. You're allowed to do that. Or are they trying to work other angles to get capital into the deal? And then, like I said, even the individual deal, if you asked, let's say you're putting a deal together and I say, hey, Justin, what do you like about the deal? What you don't like about it? And if all you're talking about things you like about the deal and there's nothing you don't like about it, I'd find that probably strange.
Right. Yeah, there's always some type of hair that you either see or don't see that you're going to have to deal with, right? So being truthful. And obviously, one of the things that I try to do is invest with my investors, right? Because I think that if you have the capital to do it, right, it's always like a good thing. But hey, are you investing in this deal yourself? Like, yep, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is thing. I haven't done that for all of them, but I explained that, hey, this is my philosophy and my way to do it. And so I like people to have a little bit of skin in the game outside of just maybe some of their time. But I'm also curious about the sentiment amongst like your investor base. Obviously, we were in a very advantageous time a few years ago where you could get a 10 cash on cash or whatever that doesn't seem to be as abundant or exist at the moment. But are you seeing or hearing from passive investors that they're like open to lower returns or like how are your investors feeling on board?
Yeah, deal flow has been slower, but I would say that there's no question that people are open to lower returns. A lot of people are like, hey, I can go to the bank and make this, but people don't like the banks right now either.
Yeah.
In some cases. Some people are just going to sit on the sidelines, especially if they have deals that maybe are not performing as well as they want to.
Right.
I think to our point earlier that you could find deals right now that will end up being really good deals. And I do think that it's harder to raise capital right now than it was, but there are a number of people out there that have capital that are going to put it in. They still believe in the business. I do think some investors are get pinged on a pretty regular basis about, hey, I heard this or about something else that happened on somebody's deal. How is my deal compared to that? And that's legit for a question. And lots of times there's more to a story than just what you maybe hear or see. So yeah, I think that it's going to be a little bit harder, but there are a number of people. I'm still investing. I'm putting a fair bit in this deal we're doing right now because I still believe in multifamily. And I think it's going to continue to do well. But we definitely have some hurdles right now in front of us.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I kind of am right along with you. I think if you can find something now, it's good. Always be looking for deals. I think that's the flavor of the month at the moment. So I want to round out with the final three questions I ask every guest on the podcast. So what is one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate investing journey?
I guess that one of the biggest pieces is that you're never going to know everything. Sometimes you just have to move forward like anything. If you're looking for 100% of all the answers before you make a decision on anything, no matter what it is, you're not going to have it. So you have to get comfortable knowing that you have known unknowns and then you have that you know about, right? And then you have unknown unknowns that you're never going to know about until something happens and you transact. So that's probably one piece there.
That's fair. What's your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
Keith Cunningham has a book, if you know him, The Road Less Stupid. I just like it because one, that's my thing too. He talks about the dumb tax and things like that as well. Very smart, successful business person. But I do like that because he talks about mistakes he's made and mistakes other people have made. And we've all made, I would say, dumb mistakes. So the biggest thing is learning from them and then sharing them with other people so they can hopefully avoid them.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole like mentor group mentality, right? Is you find people that have been more successful for longer and they typically have made the mistakes that you're trying to avoid, right? And so that's the whole model. So this will be interesting. So if you hit your financial freedom number, meaning you could live an amazing life just off of the passive income from real estate, which you may be able to do right now, what would you do?
I don't think I would ever stop working 100%. I'd probably travel more, the one thing. As I told my wife, if I wasn't doing real estate, I'd probably be a race car driver.
There you go.
I'm too old for that now. But one of those things, I actually do some stuff right now as a business with cars as well. I've always liked cars ever since a little kid. And that's something I never thought I'd be able to get into, but I was able to get into about a year and a half ago. I'd probably start doing more of that just because I like them for whatever reason. In some cases, you do some things that are not financially, if you want to say wise, right? I might do some things that, hey, maybe financially they don't make as much, but they're fun to do.
Yeah. Experiences, right? You got to live your life kind of a
thing. That's right.
Yeah.
And I've always had an issue with that pretty much my entire life. So I'm getting better at it. And I tell people that it's okay to buy something for yourself. If the thing has you, then there's an issue with that. But it's okay to buy some things here and there for yourself too, which I had an issue with before.
Got it. Well, Mark, I really appreciate the time. We probably went longer than anticipated, but this has been super helpful. So yeah, man, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin. I appreciate it.
Awesome. I hope everybody took something away from this episode. I've got another one dropping soon, so keep listening. See ya.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way, you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.